Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Turteltaub from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining us today from Santa Monica is Kate Bowles, who is a registered nurse and an attorney at Nelson Hardiman. And from New York is Tony Maida, who's a partner at McDermott Will & Emery. And we're going to be talking about changes to the physician's self-referral rule and anti-kickback statute. So what are some of the changes that CMS and OIG proposed to the physician self-referral law and anti-kickback statute?
So this is Kate, and I'll start with this question. One of the things that's going on with the kickback statute and the Stark law is this, quote, regulatory sprint to coordinated care, unquote, which is sort of a complex way of talking about trying to change some of the regulatory and legal aspects of these laws to meet what we're seeing in today's healthcare market. And so what I mean by that is, you know, we're trying to shift what we've traditionally has been a fee for service model. You perform a healthcare service, you get paid, into a model where we are recognizing that providers who are focusing on patient outcomes and improving them or decreasing costs and creating efficiencies in the healthcare market should be rewarded for that level of care. And so what we're seeing with these changes is, you know, a move from what has been that traditional model into this new model of healthcare. As it relates to the anti-kickback statute, there are specifically 12 new rules that we're going to see. One of the new proposed modifications is actually to the civil monetary penalties law, and I'll get into that later. The other 11 are really just new or modified exceptions to the kickback statute to really recognize these new models of care. Three relate to value-based entity initiatives, and then there's all sorts of different things going on with recognizing, you know, electronic healthcare record, donations of cybersecurity, personal services and management contracts, some changes to the warranties exception, across the board trying to recognize the accountable care organizations and other waivered models, putting those specifically into the kickback statute exception. So with that, I'll turn to Tony to discuss the Stark.
Sure, thank you. On the Stark side, CMS did something similar that OIG did in creating the value-based exceptions for to accommodate value-based care arrangements. But the other big thing that CMS did was attempt to try to address long-standing issues with the Stark regulations, specifically to reduce burden on a number of concepts, and most importantly being the big three that we refer to, first being the volume and value rule, and making a change in the meaning of how to interpret when compensation varies with the volume or value of referrals, in order to clear up some of the confusion that existed in the industry after the Toomey decision, specifically around paying physicians for RVU-based compensation. Number two, the CMS proposed redefining fair market value in a way to try and move away from what I call a survey says approach in relying on physician compensation surveys too strictly in determining what fair market value is. And then third, proposing a definition for the first time of the term commercial reasonableness in a way that tries to address what has been referred to as the practice loss theory that DOJ and relators have put forth in some cases, in saying that it's not the fact of whether an arrangement generates a profit for the other entity is not determinative about whether it's commercially reasonable, which I think is really important for hospital and health system arrangements, particularly those that are nonprofit, but also for profit. And CMS made other changes to exceptions, some of which are pretty detailed, but generally speaking, to try to also remove other compliance burdens in terms of meeting different compensation exceptions. The one sort of burden addition that occurred was some proposed changes to how group practices can distribute profits, and that'll be particularly relevant for physician practices to look at and pay attention in the final rule as to where CMS came out.
So speaking of where they came out, I mean, Tony, what do you think the final rules will say?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that for the most part, CMS probably is going to finalize what they proposed for the most part. A lot of the longstanding burden reduction issues that I mentioned are longstanding issues that the industry and CMS have talked about over the years, and there have been white papers and convener sessions and other dialogue with the agency over the confusion around volume of value and issues with fair market value and commercial reasonableness. So I think those probably are going to be finalized in a very similar way that was proposed. I also suspect that the value-based exceptions will probably be finalized in the way that they were proposed. There could be some tweaks around the edges because there is, there are some areas that are confusing and could use at least additional clarification, particularly around the shared loss exception. I think the group practice is up for debate. I know that there's been a lot of lobbying on the part of group practices to try to get CMS to take a different approach to their profit distribution proposal, which essentially was that created some restrictions on how you could distribute DHS profits within the group and whether or not you could sort of create separate DHS pools for different types of designated health services or whether you needed to put them all together. And I think that is to be determined because there has been a number of comments and discussions with CMS from physician practices and their trade associations around that issue. And so it'll be interesting to see where CMS comes out.
Now, Kate, what do compliance professionals need to start thinking about and doing now to prepare for the changes?
Yeah, that's a really good question. With respect to what compliance officers should be doing now, there are two rule suggestions I have. One idea would be to raise to the directors and officers or owners level of your practice, whether your healthcare provider, group, hospital, health system would be interested in linking up with another entity to engage in one of these value-based care initiatives. Now, as Tony mentioned, these, they could use a little bit of clarification. There's three in the kickback law and several other amendments to the Stark law where we're trying to create what's called a value-based enterprise or a VBE, and there's all kinds of new acronyms that are being proposed, which only makes things more confusing. But the goal essentially of a value-based enterprise would be to have maybe a hospital link up with an emergency room group and be able to coordinate, patients who are getting admitted or maybe readmitted often. How can we coordinate these two groups of providers to try to reduce readmission rates, for example, or keep patients in the community and treat them without coming to the emergency room? Is there a way that we can move from just, paying each individual provider for their service to having these two groups work together toward a common goal and really self-monitor as far as whether they're meeting that goal, report themselves to the government as far as what quality initiatives they've achieved or have not achieved, have they failed? What is their target population going to be? Is this target population going to, be put together? It's going to have to be put together in a non-discriminatory way. So those are the types of things that you can start looking at as a compliance officer is whether there's some entity out there that you could partner with that could potentially engage in one of these value-based initiatives. And I would say the second piece of that I would recommend would be to perhaps look at some of your aging contracts and business deals and try to determine if they are really the type of ventures that are going to make sense in this new environment. If assuming these rules are finalized largely as they've been written, would it be a good idea to approach some of your business partners or joint venturers to discuss whether your relationship should be modified or simply terminated to free up resources and opportunities for new ventures? So those are the two main points that I would recommend.
So in the meantime, in this period, you know, before new changes happen and while people are looking to put stuff in place, what do recent enforcement actions indicate compliance teams should be looking at within their own organizations? Tony, do you want to go first on that?
Sure. I think if anything, we can say with absolute certainty that the government and relators have been and will continue to be interested in pursuing cases on anti-kickback and Stark issues. And I think that'll continue in the future, sort of regardless of whether these rules are finalized or not. The scope of those enforcement actions will change, and in some ways, a lot of the litigation risk around Stark issues will decrease, but they'll still exist. And so from a compliance perspective, I think it's important to, one, have a process in place for determining fair market value for physician compensation and the commercial reasonableness of entering into an arrangement, right? What is the business rationale or purpose behind the arrangement? And having contemporaneous documentation of that at the time the arrangement is entered into. And two, monitoring compliance with those arrangements, with the terms of those arrangements, having timesheets or other evidence that work was performed, that if circumstances change, that, you know, an arrangement is no longer needed, that it is somehow either addressed or modified or terminated if necessary, that the compliance program, you know, traditional function and what compliance professionals do is, one, have a process in place to make sure that the arrangements are entered into appropriately, and then two, monitoring and auditing those arrangements in the future so that they can maintain compliance or detect an issue that needs to be remedied.
So we're talking about the future, and the future is rarely as unclear as it is now with the COVID-19 pandemic. How has the ground changed for this risk area because of it?
So one thing you don't see a lot in these new proposed exceptions is any significant expansion of the role of telehealth. So I'll return quickly to, I had mentioned there's a change to the definition of remuneration under the civil monetary penalties law, and that change actually relates to telehealth, specifically trying to exclude from this idea of remuneration that telehealth technologies that are provided to patients to assist with care and to improve outcomes. So that would essentially be, you know, a patient inducement that potentially could be provided to a target population to help them stay compliant with their healthcare regimen to see their healthcare providers without risking sort of civil monetary penalty exclusion or fines for providing that patient inducement. But we don't really see much else, at least in the kickback, the new proposed exceptions that's really surrounding telehealth. And just given where we are, I do think regardless of when and if we return, you know, to doing business as usual in the coming months, there's still going to be a need for telehealth role that's expanded and increased. And so I actually wouldn't be surprised if this year we do see some additional proposed rules that relate to the telehealth industry, especially as it seems that sort of the relaxations of the telehealth rules so far with respect to CMS have gone fairly well in terms of, you know, providers being able to reach patients and see elderly patients in their home setting without risking them having exposure to COVID-19. And so unless and until we get, you know, a treatment in place for coronavirus, potentially vaccine in place, I think that those telehealth rules do need to be looked at again and hopefully will be in the coming months.
I was going to say, I think that's right. I mean, I think we'll see probably first some informal guidance from OIG. They've issued the policy statement around anti-kickback statute that sort of adheres to the Stark blanket waiver. I think the Stark blanket waivers are important from a compliance perspective because they've created some additional flexibility during the pandemic period of time. But they don't answer all of the questions, or they don't waive every element of exception. So there's still an important compliance component to Stark compliance, even with the waivers. And on the AKS side, you know, OIG is potentially going to issue additional FAQs that might get at things like the telehealth issues Kate mentioned. But I do see on the horizon sort of a more a need for a more permanent way to address things like telehealth, which I think are probably not going to go away anytime soon, even when the pandemic ends, in light of the potential for resurgence and, you know, just how people have changed the way they do business and deliver care.
Well, it's one of the many things that we'll be all interested to see what happens. Well, Kate, Tony, thank you for sharing those insights with us. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA. I hope we were able to expand your compliance perspective.